Good evening.
My name is Sean. Thank you for being here. I just want to share, not really a question, but a series of thoughts that I typed in my phone as you were speaking. Yeah, I want to honestly say I'm a very confused person. Although I have been practicing or attending retreats and Rishi programs, but I honestly want to say that I realized I don't know a lot. So when Najat is talking about liberation, I was just thinking liberation from what is the meaning? What is the flavor of liberation? And I was reflecting upon myself and my life, and I realized, is it important to stick to beliefs, or is it important to know what is more important? I realized my beliefs are all an accumulation of knowledge, of my memories, and based on authority, or is it based on scriptures, or is it based on whatever's an older agenda? Or is it hearsay, or is it I follow the crowd, or my community, or my Buddhist community, or do I investigate and know myself? What if I get Alzheimer's one day and I lose all this memory, but I still have that wisdom? This is more important. I also ask myself, I seem to have this preoccupation about being good. And also hear that among my friends and families and in my community. Being a good son, being a good Buddhist, a good person, going after a good rebirth. Is this what's important for us? Being good, doing good, acting good?
And I think maybe that's enough, and I'll just answer as we have a short time. Yeah, I just pick up on this word good for a while, because it's again one of these surprisingly difficult words to define, isn't it? What does it mean to be good? And if you're I've been using bank robbery as an example on a number of occasions today. If you were a bank robber, you'd probably try and be a good bank robber, wouldn't you? So your idea of good would probably not be the same as the view of all the people who had money in the bank. So what does it mean? You say, well, all religions tell us to be good. What is that a meaningful statement? What does that really tell us? So, in short, I would say that we can only have a clear idea of what good means when we have decided what is best. Okay, so, and then the good is that which inclines towards the best. Okay? So the best or the highest or the goal. So in Buddha, Buddha Dhamma, then the highest goal is Nibbana, or liberation from suffering and all defilement. So we can say as Buddhists, goodness are any actions of body, speech and mind which lead to a reduction of greed, hatred and delusion, and a growth in wisdom, compassion and purity. So this is our criteria. So if you have other philosophies and other religions with a different ultimate goal, then their good maybe will have some overlap with Buddhist good, but if their ultimate goal is not Nibbana, it will not be the same thing. We can all call it good, but their goodness and our goodness is not necessarily the same thing, because it's not related to the same goal. Mm. Coming down a bit, so we are expected, what does it mean to be a good son? So that this is an intermediate goal. And then once we have our ideal, then we try to act in ways which are in harmony with that. But I think that, In Buddhist psychology, we're always trying to move away from the sense of the person to the action. So for instance, one way of talking about difference between Eastern cultures and Western culture is the difference between a shame culture and a guilt culture. So like the West is very much guilt culture. You know, it's very difficult for people from Asia to really understand the nature of guilt. If you speak with a Western person about it, it's kind of weird, kind of, it sounds like a mental disease, really. But to simplify this idea, because I did a bad thing, I'm a bad person. That's got the essence of it. I'm such a bad person. I'm so much worse than you know. Why? Because I did all these bad things. So this is the sense that bad actions mean bad person. But in the Buddhist, like you say, bad actions mean bad actions. There's no need to create this idea of a bad person and make it more complicated than it needs to be. Now this movement away from like nouns to verbs is really very much part of the path of wisdom. And to give a secular example, I think some of you may have heard. I can't remember the name of this scientist, but she's done a lot of research on the idea of being smart. So, in one example, a number of students from Harvard, I believe, were given a psychological like questionnaire about how they perceive themselves. And smuggled into it is just the one question they really want to ask. Do you consider yourself smart? Okay. And then they had all of these students go into another room where they were given a sort of IQ test, but it was made very easy for them to cheat. And so there were hidden cameras. And so they wanted to see how many of these students cheated and then to correlate it to whether or not they believe themselves to be smart. And there's a big correlation, a very clear correlation between students who believe themselves smart and the ones who cheated. You see, because once you take smartness or intelligence as a quality, as who you are, I'm a smart person, then all kinds of negative consequences arise. One is that testing becomes not just a test of your knowledge, it's a test of who you are. Test, are you really who you say you are? Are you really smart? Because if you're really smart, you should get good marks in this. So there's a lot of, anytime people who believe they're smart are tested, they have much more stress than people who don't feel that, because it's who they are. And so there's that much more temptation to cheat. They also find it very hard, much harder to recover afterwards if they don't do well in tests. also, if you're very invested in smart, it reduces your creativity, because when you're creative endeavors, it may be 99 times wrong before you get one time you're right. So if you're invested in always being right, and on being right as a proof of being smart, you don't want to take those kind of risks so much. So what this research pointed to is that when you praise children, for instance, you don't praise, oh, you're so smart. Oh, you're so intelligent, you know. And because this is actually not good for the child. But if you're very precise and you praise the child's effort, see? So it's an action, it's a verb rather than a state of being, okay? So you say, oh, you must have put so much work into that. It's really, that's really paid off. So when a child is tested, it's a test of how much effort and how wise an effort is put into preparation. And if the child doesn't do well, then his conclusion is, I didn't put enough effort in, or I didn't put the right kind of effort in. So it's not a sense, it's not having any impact on his sense self-esteem or self-respect or self-image. So This is a kind of a roundabout answer to your question, isn't it? But the point being that it's not like to be a good person or a good Buddhist or a good this, but devoting yourself to good actions. And what kinds of actions, what kind of speech should be cultivated by one who wants to honor their parents in the best possible way and to cultivate those actions. And always seeing it in terms of actions of body, speech and mind rather than a sense of who I am as a person, because then you're on very, very shaky. It might seem you're on solid ground, but in fact it's quicksand, you know, it's not the wisest way to go. Okay, this is a favorite topic of mine, so let me answer somebody else's question. Yeah.
Hmm. Good evening. Out of just now you mentioned about as we meditate, practice the Dharma, the defilements will come clearer and clearer. Mm. So as the defilements become clearer, and then you notice it's getting more and more. So how do you contain it and how to deal with it so that you can really practice to get rid of the defilement one by one? How to stabilize it?
Yes, in many ways it's a very simple and straightforward. You create a real interest and devotion and commitment to your meditation object. So you have to have that emotion, not just understand the technique. You have to create and sustain this real interest and commitment to it, what we call chanda or dhammachanda. And then every now and then, you know, your mind will still wander and you realize, and you just very gently but firmly put it down and come back. And it goes again and you do the same. And at this point, the dangers are boredom, discouragement, all these things. So these are the second level defilements. So indulging in some kind of memory or imagination. So that's one level of defilement. But then when you put it down, a sense of weariness and doubt, and is this really worth it? I'm just wasting my time. This is the fifth hindrance. Or the sense of, I'm bored doing this, or it's just too hard. And just that sense of aversion. This is a second hindrance. So you're getting two levels of hindrance arising. But if you say, yeah, it's okay, just put it down, come back. Down and come back, and the more you do it, the easier it becomes. But in any skill, you have to go through that first period. You're going to play the piano, you know. You have to learn all the notes, you know. And it's not fun at all. But you stay with it because you want to be able to play a Beethoven sonata or something. So you have that in your mind. You see, this is how you encourage yourself. You say, yeah, it's tough right now, but it's worth it. And this is how you encourage yourself in meditation. Yeah, it's tough right now, but everyone who's, you know, all the great teachers say, you know, same thing. They're not lying. They say, if you stay with it, you'll get better and better. And then the gaps between the distraction will start to become longer than the distraction. Also, by letting go of the defilements, you're reminding yourself, this is not who you really are, because if it was, you wouldn't be able to let go of it. It's something that comes into the mind. It's something exterior that comes into the mind. So you're becoming sharper and sharper, and the mind becoming more and more stable. But you just have to be very patient to begin with. And this is like, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. You know, it's to take a long time. But it's really worth it. You know, I've never met anybody who's, you know, even given years to doing this and then having some success and say, wow, what a disappointment. You know, it's not like, you know, used to people say, yeah, I went all the way to Kathmandu, or I went on holiday here, and in the end, well, it's all right, you know. They say, like, worldly things, this is very common, you know. There's very few places you can go. I've been a lot of places, and there's very few places that are as good as the photographs, you know, but But with meditation, you never hear that. I mean, it exceeds expectations rather than doesn't live up to them. So bear with it, is basically it. So just one point I wanted to share with you, and I think you know, this whole sense of the bridge. This is the kind of the holy grail, the bridge between formal meditation and mindfulness and daily life. And I think that the way to look at this is in terms of the four right efforts. Okay? So when you're meditating, what in terms of effort, what exactly are you doing? One, you're learning the skill of looking after your mind in such a way that the defilement can't take over your mind. But as that's you're not going to be very successful at that to begin with. So you need a second effort, is that when defilements do take over your mind, you know how to let go of them. Thirdly, you're trying to create and to bring and to instill in the mind the enlightenment factors, the seven bodhjhanas. And fourthly, when these enlightenment factors of mindfulness and bhiti and so on have arisen, you're developing the skill to look after them and to develop them further. These are four right efforts. So in daily life, you know, you're driving to work or you're at work or you're with family, how do you practice, you know, when it's you know, you can't be with your breath? So what do you do? Your practice is, how can I prevent defilements arising in my mind right now? So like, so let's say when you drive to work, maybe you tend to get irritated with people who drive in a very selfish way or inconsiderate way. So this is your goal. Yeah, I'm going to drive to work and I'm going to try and look after my mind in such a way that I don't get irritated with people who drive in a selfish, careless way. So you can, in each different part of the day, you know, your first intention is to look after your mind, and you say, yeah, this is the kind of defilement that usually comes up in this time of day, or in this. So how can I get through this time of day without that happening? Or in the occasions when it does happen, then how can I deal with it skillfully? So what are the wholesome qualities that I could try to develop? Oh, I've got to go into a meeting today, a long meeting, and you know, they just talk and they don't keep to the topic they're supposed to talk about, and they go on and on and on. So yeah, I'm going to develop patience. You see, so instead of being a real kind of torment, it's and I can really develop patience. And you notice that maybe you find it very difficult to listen with respect to some people, so you're developing that non-judgmental listening, developing ability to speak at the right time and place and to speak well in a way that will communicate with people. So you say, yeah, I can develop the right speech, communication skills, patience, contentment, mindfulness. So I think that once you look in practice, not in terms of, oh, you know, I haven't had any time to sit and meditate today, I've been so busy. When you see both the formal meditation and the daily meditation in terms of these four right efforts, you can find there's always one of those four efforts that you can be working on wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whoever you're with. You can always put forth right effort. So, you know, if you think, ah, oh, it's no time to meditate today, you know, don't look at it like that. Yeah. Yes.
At the beginning of your talk, you talked about living in community and the attachment to view and conceit. Can you give us some advice on working with attachment to view and conceit?
Yeah, well, you know, some people are just so, you know, sure of themselves, you know, that then they need to, you know, they have there's a mantra for them. So you have to, if you're someone who tend to be overly confident, then you have to be reciting in your mind, maybe I'm wrong. And if you're one of these kind of timid people, you know, these don't dare say anything because you think probably people laugh at you, you say, maybe I'm right. And yeah, really, it's a good way of thinking. If you're overly confident, it's good to go back into your past and try to mine it for occasions where you were really sure about something and you were wrong. And to have that as like something that you can bring to your mind like an antidote when you feel you're getting very uptight about something. The thing with views is that when you become identified with them, just like I say, with being smart, it doesn't become a question of the view anymore. It's about you, you know. And so often people hold on to views, even though intellectually they know that yes, but they just can't admit to it because. It's saying something about themselves. They feel that that's an admission that they're wrong and they're mistaken and they're bad or something. So, you know, taking up a view, and you know, where does a view come from? As I say, this gentleman was saying, you know, it's from information. Start off with information that you've heard, you've read, studied. But how can you be 100% sure that the information on which you base your view is accurate, is correct? Well, not 100%, you can't. And even if you are very confident that the information that you have is correct, can you be sure that it's all the information that you need? Because you look at the history of science, so you're really smart people and they have a body of information which is conditioned by the technology available to them at the time. And they make, you know, can create very very good hypotheses based upon that information. But you get new technology, more information, and the theory has to change to accommodate the information. So it wasn't that they were incorrect. Given the amount of information that they had, that was a very intelligent hypothesis. But this may be, and so with science, we can't tell. You know, as technology increases, then we're constantly having to rejig the theories and hypotheses to explain it. So, and our own blind spots are and our own defilements that come into. So, observing this and seeing, yeah, it's, you know, I stand by this. This is my view right now, but you know, I could be wrong. You know, I'm willing to stand up and explain why I think I'm right. I'm not going to just let anybody push me over. And you know, but at the same time, there has to be that little bit of humility and say, yeah, maybe I'm wrong. And having that kind of flexibility and that, again, it's that sense of, as a Buddhist, as being a learner, of being someone who's studying and learning about life and learning about being alive, and taking joy in that learning and growth rather than taking fixed positions and protecting them and sort of creating a stone wall around yourself. Excuse me. Yes. Again, it's not. excuse me. You know, that kind of judgment is fine. That when you are, you know, as Buddhists, obviously we we're more convinced that the Buddha's got it right rather than some other religious leaders. But the point is, here we're talking about that identification with it, and you know, when people find it absolutely intolerable that people still hold on to these views, even though it's so obvious that they're wrong. Why can't they see? Why can't? You know, and this is that all the negative emotions that arise. But as Buddhists, when we see someone who has a very strong faith in something that we don't agree in, you know, we don't have any concept of or idea of trying to convert them, and we don't want to say anything that would upset them. And it's like a Buddhist monk, for instance. I'm not allowed to teach somebody who doesn't ask to be taught. I can't just go up and, you know, knock on your door and give you the good news about Buddhism. Or, you know, I literally can't teach you unless you really want to be taught. This is one of the reasons why I have this kind of uniform, you know, so you know this is someone who knows something about it. You know, you can ask me. I found in talking with people with other religions, whether it's Christianity or Islam, that yeah, it's difficult. But saying, for instance, are you like the best possible Christian that you could be? Well, of course, somebody would say no, of course not. So I say, what exactly is it, do you think, that prevents you from being the kind of Christian or the kind of Muslim that you think you would like to be or you should be? And then people will say, well, yeah, I got a bad temper, or you know, I get very greedy sometimes, and I'm very... And then, you see, now you're into the real world of defilements and working with defilements. And you say, well, yeah, you know, this Buddhism's got some really good teachings for dealing with that, you know, to... You know, so it's not like a sneaky way to convert someone to Buddhism. But it's helping someone to be a better Muslim or a better Christian. And I think that that's something that... as Buddhists, we can offer people, because Buddhism has the tools. You know, this is my frustration in growing up in England or something, that it seemed to me the religious teachings are telling you should be like this. And you say, okay, yeah, I turn the other cheek and all these kind of things. Yeah, that's good, I like that, but I can't do it. So what do I do now? And there's nothing there, you know, and there's no practical... link between where you are now and where the religion is telling you should be. And this seemed to me a major cause of this, like, guilt culture, that people, you're not able to live up to the standards that you're encouraged to uphold. And I think that, you know, as they say, this is the strong point of Buddhism, that you only have to be a Buddhist to, you know, look at your mind or even to, you know, your breath. It's not, we don't have a trademark on the inhalation and the exhalation. You know, anybody could do that. So I like the idea of Buddhists as being, of having skills and tools that if members of other religions are interested, that we can share with them without threatening their beliefs at all. Yeah. One more, maybe, before we go. I haven't been here for, was it 9 years? So I have one more question.
Yes. Question. I want to ask a question. Anyone would like to ask a question? Not maybe I represent, I think that some devotees always have the concern of helping the dearest people to us. The ones that we love are most our parents or spouses or children. So what is Han Chan's advice for us to help the closest to us to understand Dhamma and also to follow the Dhamma's way?
Well, number one thing not to do is to start giving them sermons about Buddhism. And actions speak louder than words, and if you are practicing Buddhism, and they can see that you are more peaceful than you used to be, you're kinder, you're more grounded, and just they see the positive effects that Buddhist teachings have upon you, then they're going to start becoming interested, at least a little, maybe not so much, but again, if they have some Buddhist background and they have some sympathy, then sometimes you can say, I heard some really profound thing today. The teacher said, sometimes when I hear these things, I feel like I like to share them with you. Would you like to hear these things sometimes or not? And so you're always giving them the choice. It's not like you're pushing something onto them. You're saying, look, this is such an important part of my life, and I because I love you, I want to share it with you, but I don't want to, impose this upon you. But if you do have some interest, I'd be happy to tell you some of these things. So very, very just gently, slowly, with great respect. And if someone's not open, then that's all right too. And sometimes it takes some time. Maybe I'll just tell you this story. It's a true story. I have a student of mine, a monk who is now living in Germany. And so I visit him sometimes, as I'm kind of the advisor to his monastery. So he has a very good study program, sutta study program. He has meditation retreats. So at the end of my visit, he said, is there anything that you would suggest that we need to change or develop? And I said, no, I think your study program is very good, your meditation retreat's very good, but what I would like you to introduce to your students is teachings on filial piety, and try to encourage them to give more attention and care to their parents. So I said, oh, yeah, Ajahn, that's a tough one, this is Germany, yeah. So anyway, I said, well, see what you can do. And some few months later, he wrote back. He phoned me, and we were having this. He said, I had my first success. I do take on board what you tell me. So one of his closest disciples, a young woman, she heard that I made this request, and so she took it seriously. Her parents weren't married when she was born, and it was not an intentional pregnancy, and the parents were both young, and the husband particularly felt very resentful and angry, feeling like pinned down now with a young wife and kid. So sort of an old story. But things escalated, and when she was a baby, father went out, got drunk, came back in a rage, went in and picked up the baby and started to choke her. He's going to kill his own baby. And the wife came in, fortunately in time, and screamed and fought him off. The baby was left in the cot, and the husband disappeared, and that was the end of their relationship. And she never met her father ever again after that. Never knew her father. So she's the one who decided to get in touch with her father, who almost killed her when she was a baby. And so she did. She Googled and tried to find out where he was and whether he was still in the city. And eventually she got an email address and wrote to him and said, I'm your daughter, and I wonder whether you would be interested in some correspondence. They started to correspond, and this increased over some time. And then it progressed to telephone conversations, and every Sunday they would have a telephone conversation, which got longer and longer. And then one day she said, you know, we talk about this kind of very, we have good conversations, don't we? But it's kind of a little bit, I wonder whether you'd be interested in having kind of a theme, you know, we could talk about, you know. So your theme, yeah? Yeah, all right. What do you want to? Well, this theme is called the five precepts. So I thought we could talk about like one a week. Yeah, would you? He said, yeah, okay, why not? So she started teaching the five precepts one a week. And eventually they got together and had a meal together. And finally, he's going to take her to the monastery. She's going to take going to. And by this time, his life had changed and he'd become quite a successful businessman in a building supply company. And he got to the monastery and they're doing some renovations. He said, "That, what are they using? That's really low quality. Yeah, I'll see to this." And so he volunteered to help with the renovation of the monastery. And this young woman's mother is also a disciple of the monastery. And so the husband and the father met the mother for the first time at the monastery, and they she forgave him, and they get on quite well. And so, yeah, that's the story of German filial piety. Yeah, so I think quite. So yeah, that's you know, when you think if you have a difficult parent, you know, then you think, well, this German lady, you know, she took this on with a father who tried to kill her when she was a few months old and then abandoned her for the rest of her life. And now they're very close, and it's a beautiful story, I think.
Inspiring evening. I'm sure many of us are beyond words in terms of gratitude and appreciation. Just a show of hands, how many people feel happier having attended this session? A very good Buddhist. That's the definition of goodness. Leaning towards what is the best. And I think tonight we had one of the best, one of the clearest talks on Dhamma for a long time. It is profound, it is in its simplicity. Dhamma need not be very complicated or sounds very sophisticated. It could be as simple as what Tanajan gave us, the practice of sila or morality. It's Mahatanna, is the great gift towards the world. The world is lacking in safety. And if we just give our precepts, that's the basis of practice. Not only we give the world safety, but we ourselves feel very confident and safe. And in it is the seeds of wisdom and insight into Dhamma. So I think we are all very thankful, Tanajan, and we hope that we will come back more often to give us this kind of illuminating teachings that we need. We also wish Tanajan Edban's birthday. Happy birthday in advance, and hope you enjoy the special gift that you are going to give yourself. And I think in Malaysia and throughout Singapore, Thailand, everywhere where your followers and disciples are, they are also wishing for your happiness, for your success, for your well-being, for your safety, Tanajan, because you are very important to many people, including all of us here at Nalanda. The Buddha once said, Kilapu Purisa Chanyu Naso Sabata Jayati Yatasu Chayati Hiro Pankuyam Sukhamitati. A person who is wise and well-practiced. They are not born in every family. I don't know about your family. My family we don't have. Wise, not yet. They are not even born in every village or even every other province. But whenever a wise person is born, that community tribes happening, they are joyful, they are peaceful, they are purposeful. And Tanatan, coming to Nananta for many times, I know it's a very great honor because once the Kapion that followed Tanatan to Nananta told me in private, he said, you know, Tanatan seldom travel to the same country twice. What more to the same center twice? But we have done this greater honor and greater service than coming twice, Tanatan. And we hope we can come back again and again and again. And tonight also I'd like to thank everyone for being here, not least our friends from Thailand and also Singapore. We've just driven up and tomorrow morning early they are leaving with Tanatan to Singapore. So for your friends and relatives in Singapore, please let them know. I suppose there are sessions in Singapore, Tanatan, teaching sessions you can find out from social media. And similarly, you can find out about the teachings here at Nalanda Center from social media, from the Nalanda Facebook, or from Nalanda website, or better still, to sign up as one of the recipients of the weekly email updates. You can do so on our website on the main page itself. This month being the Sangha month, from the 7th of November to the 7th of December, we have actually many illustrious teachers, monks and nuns, who are coming here to give teachings. And next week is the middle of the month, when we are going to celebrate Sangha Day on the 12th of November in Nalanda Center in KL, and 19th of November here at Nalanda Center, where we will have a great opportunity to offer requisites, to offer food, to offer robes to venerable Sangha members. And to finish the program for the Sangha month, we will have Venerable Thupten Chutun. Many of you may have heard of her. She's a famous teacher and author as well. She'll be staying here. She has been invited to Malaysia by some Buddhist groups, and they have chosen to place her at Nalanda Center. Maybe our food here is better. The crowd here is more appreciative of Dharma, and you know, you can see so many people genuinely interested to learn. So Venerable Thupten Chutun is going to give three consecutive nights of class. So do find out more from the social media platform or from our website. And tonight, I'd like to thank everyone for being here. Not least our senior Nalandian Acharya Vijaya is here with Auntie Amita. Thank you for coming, Acharya. And also we have Acharya Siam Chai family is also here. Thank you. And for all of you who have braved the rain, the traffic, and Friday, thank goodness it's Friday, because we can all listen to Dharma with a lot of relaxed mind, relaxed body. So with this, we'd like to again thank everyone, and especially to thank Tanatan for gracing Malaysia, and also to thank those who have invited Tanatan to Malaysia. This time, Tanatan didn't come at Nalanda's invitation. Not that we didn't want to invite Tanatan. I invited Tanatan many times. He has been working on a project, very important projects, to collect the live biography, the words, more importantly, the teachings of Achancha, the teachings of Tama, especially through the forest tradition. And the book is finally out, and we are very happy to also get permission from Tanatan to reprint those books in Malaysia. So last Wednesday, we reprinted Tanatan's excellent book on Theravada Buddhism. It's called Without and Within. We still have copies available, please ask for them. And this year, we dedicated the printing. Usually we do from May to July. This year, we printed Achan Buddhadasa's bookings, reprinted all of them, in the process of doing more. But next year, we have gotten permission from Ajahn Saru to print some of his works, and probably also to compile some of his longhand writings, some of the very good sayings, good sayings, for the benefit of Malaysian Singaporeans, as well as Buddhists throughout the world. And we're also going to do some of the translations, hopefully, because one of Ajahn's very strong feeling is to help the growing Buddhist community in India, and we have been tasked with doing that as well. And Nananda has been doing faithfully over the years, and we have started some programs, and some of the books we hope to get to be translated into local Indian languages and vernacular, and to be distributed fully through India. So these are many more. So I invite everyone to come and join this burgeoning community, as well as the movement. We can see in Malaysia there's a lot of interest. We can see around a lot of young faces. If you admit yourself as young, there is a growing need, and there is a growing feel and interest towards this Dhamma. So we hope Tanatan and also other monks from the forest tradition can grace our shores in Malaysia more often and give us something that we can lean towards, something that is good, that leans towards the best. So please join me in rejoicing in this very rare gathering, very auspicious night, by saying resoundingly, Sadhu.
Sadhu, Sadhu,
Sadhu. We'd like to invite him to give a blessing for everyone. Also to Auntie Tan, the family is here, who passed away 2 weeks ago.
I've got no voice left.
So yeah. We also keep in mind Auntie Tan in our prayers. So maybe we meet Tan and Zan.
I don't know if I've got enough voice left for the blessing. I'll let me try.
Yatha varivaha pura paripurenti sagarang eva me vaito tinnang petanang upakapate ichitang matitang dumhang kipamiva samichato saphe porendu sankapa Janto panaraso yatha manicho tiraso yatha sabhitiyo yuachanto sabharukho vinasato mate amovatvantarayo sukhi thikayukho bhava apivatanasilisa nityang udhapachayino chataro thammavatante Ayo vanno sukhang phalang.
Brothers and sisters, let us pay respects to Kamatana, as well as the teachers of the Kamatana.
Putang vandhari bhante Dhammam vandhami bhante Sangham vandhami bhante